got a sprain or an itch.
Welcome to another edition of the Hey Doc Show. Harold Lasky is both the medical director and a physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. Dr. Lasky will be your host for the next half hour. With him is his lovely wife Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT and X-ray tech. Together, they hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
What do we got here this week? Well, it's another newsworthy week. Afghanistan's fallen. Coronavirus is still with us. The governor of Florida is being sued by various school boards. And of course, we have the proposed LERP statue or monument to be built on the site of the old Jacksonville Landing. I can just imagine all those vacationers staring in awe at this magnificent $18 million construction, boldly presenting the nickname of Jacksonville, LERP, as they continue traveling to their vacation destination, Orlando. Let's talk about diabetes. Over 34 million Americans, or 10.5% of the population, have diabetes. And of that number, 1.6 million Americans have type 1, and the rest, 32 million, with type 2. And every year, there are approximately 1.5 million Americans newly diagnosed, and there are 88 million Americans age 18 and older that are considered to have pre-diabetes. And we'll explain all of that during the show. Now, there are several entities or diseases that carry the name diabetes. The first two are the more well-known ones that should actually be called diabetes mellitus, while there's a third called diabetes insipidus. And we'll talk about that last one on another show, since it is much rarer than the first two.
So we had diabetes mellitus type 1 and diabetes mellitus type 2. For the rest of the show, we will just call them diabetes 1 and 2.
Both of those diseases are characterized by a high level of glucose, better known as sugar in the blood. That's the reason that we're always checking on blood glucose levels in our patients. When there's too much sugar in the blood, there can arise serious and even life-threatening problems.
When there is too much sugar in the blood, it can also mean that there is not enough sugar in those organs that need it. But we will get back to that later.
There's also a type of diabetes that is transient, meaning that it only occurs under a certain condition, and that is pregnancy. It's called gestational diabetes. We do have a stage often called pre-diabetes when the blood sugar is, well, on the borderline of being considered full-blown diabetes. Nevertheless, it too can be a dangerous time. So let's start our discussion with a food journey. You just ate lunch, which included the three food groups: fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. The carbohydrates are basically sugars.
These sugars break down into glucose, the form of sugar that your body can use for energy. In the walls of the GI tract are myriads of blood vessels which absorb these sugars in order to carry them to the organs that need them.
The big problem here is what happens if the organs cannot remove these sugars to use for their energy. They cannot do it on their own, as they need a particular hormone called insulin that is made in the pancreas.
The problems occur when either the insulin is not being produced in response to the sugar level in the blood, or the insulin is either not produced in enough quantities, or is a, let us call it, inferior insulin that is weak and cannot do its job.
Remember the stories of the Pony Express that in the early years in the Wild West transported mail from town to town? Most of the time, it got through and the mail was delivered, but sometimes they were robbed, or the riders or horses were simply not strong enough to make the trip. Anyway, in this case, there were four possibilities.
All the mail got through. In this case, the horse and rider were competent for the task.
Some of the mail got through. Maybe the horse was strong, but the rider could not protect the mail from thieves.
Or maybe vice versa. The horse could not make it even with a competent rider.
Or none of the mail got through. In other words, horse and rider were weak or not in sufficient quantity to carry all the mail. Well, same case here in diabetes. Of course, we're not talking about mail.
First, we need good insulin that does its job But then we also need enough of this good insulin to complete the job.
There are cells in the pancreas that are called beta cells, and these are the insulin factories. They respond to levels of sugar in the blood. When the system is working correctly, high levels of sugar in the blood stimulate the secretion of higher amounts of insulin.
When the glucose levels decrease, there is less insulin being produced. Thus, there is a narrow level of glucose in the blood, and this keeps us healthy.
Remember that the body is simply an amazing thing. Most of the functions are truly self-regulating. Too much of a substance like sugar, and the body starts producing hormones that will decrease the amount. Once it decreases to a certain level, then the body stops stimulating the production of these hormones. In that way, the body keeps many things within normal range. Now, in a lot of diseases, there are changes in the production of hormones.
In the case of diabetes, the pancreas may produce insufficient amount of insulin, or it may produce the appropriate amount of insulin, but the insulin it produces is not capable of doing what it normally should do.
Diabetes type 1 is really an autoimmune disease, as the beta cells of the pancreas are destroyed by the body's own immune system. Now you may be asking, why the body does this? What causes the body to attack its own beta cells? Part of the story, to attack its own beta cells? Well, it's certainly genetic. But the rest of the story is really still unknown. Nevertheless, in diabetes type 1, insulin production is reduced. Less insulin binds to the receptors on the target cells, causing less glucose to be taken into the cells, and therefore more glucose stays in the blood. So the immediate result is that the cells do not get enough glucose.
By the accumulation of increased glucose in the blood, for long-term elevation can do marked damage to many organ systems, like the kidneys and the heart.
Type 1 diabetes often shows early onset, most often in children and usually before the age of 20. Because in type 1 diabetes there is usually no insulin being produced, then those patients with this form of the disease most often need insulin injections to maintain the blood glucose levels. These patients are considered insulin dependent.
In type 2 diabetes, there is production of insulin in the pancreas. However, something goes amiss either in the receptor binding or something called insulin signaling inside the target cells. Either way, the cells are not responsive to the insulin as they would be in normal individuals.
So the cells cannot import sufficient glucose to meet their needs. Again, since the insulin is not absorbed in the cells appropriately, there will be more glucose that remains floating around in the blood. So here we could call these diabetics insulin resistant. Now, genetics is also considered to be a factor in type 2 diabetes, but lifestyle also plays a very important role in this particular case.
Some of the factors that can be associated with type 2 diabetes are obesity, an inactive lifestyle, and an unhealthy diet.
Usually type 2 diabetes starts in the later years. In other words, it's most often seen in adults. And unlike type 1, diabetes is associated with gradual onset. It usually begins after the age of 30, and between 80 and 90% of all diabetics have type 2 diabetes. The basics of management here include weight loss for those who are overweight and a low carbohydrate diet in most diabetics.
One serious complication of diabetes is an emergency called DKA. Or diabetic ketoacidosis. It can be a life-threatening problem.
Each year, there are around 135,000 hospital admissions due to DKA. Now, that's around 375 a day, and it costs about $2.4 billion annually. Now, to better understand DKA, think of a cell which has an outer membrane. It kind of looks like a balloon, at least to me it does.
There are multiple glucose receptors on the outside of this cell membrane looking to capture glucose floating in the blood.
Inside the cell, among other things, are fatty acids and mitochondria, which can be thought of as the little factories within the cells. Once the glucose or sugar molecules get into the cell, they're exposed to a process that converts them to another form, that eventually gets inside those mitochondria along with some of the fatty acids that float within the cell itself.
So insulin that is floating around in the blood attaches to the cell's receptors, helping glucose to enter the cell and prevent some of the fatty acids from doing the same.
Once the glucose is in the mitochondria, it is then transformed into energy that the cell can use.
Now, let's look at diabetes type 1, where there is no insulin being produced, and type 2, where there is either little insulin produced or damaged insulin being produced.
Now here, there's very little glucose entering the cell. Thus, this mode of energy source is not available to the cell. And along with this are other results of the decreased insulin, including the increase of certain other chemicals which can be used in the mitochondria as energy forms.
The problem is that they are poorer energy forms than glucose, and the byproduct of this chemical reaction is acetone and acetoacetate, and something called beta-hydroxybutyrate.
These are considered ketone bodies. The acetone changes into a gas, which is often the smell that you notice on the breath of diabetics in ketoacidosis. What results is that there is no inhibition of fatty acid transport, since there's a decrease in insulin that normally does this in the body.
Since there is no inhibition of the transport of fatty acids, then there will be a large amount of fatty acids entering the mitochondria.
Remember that we mentioned that along with all of these ketone bodies, they are being produced in excess, and these bodies are very acidic.
The increase in glucose in the blood leads to dehydration. It does this by affecting the kidneys, which begin to pour out urine, thus dehydrating the body.
The dehydration causes potassium to shift out of your cells, which are normally in equilibrium with sodium.
And this can lead to total body potassium depletion, along with a life-threatening dehydration.
So, before we get to a newer form of insulin pump, we want to mention a new way of diagnosing diabetes.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Dr. Lasky has been the director and physician at the care center for over 34 years. They are located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection, between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office. They will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Dr. Lasky and Carmen are proud to welcome Dr. Pollan, a board-certified pain management physician, to the practice. The office emphasizes the treatment of chronic pain. They also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any question about Southside Medical Center, please call their office at 641-4411. That's Southside Medical Center, where your health is their primary care.
Let's take a human breath, for example. In human exhaled breath, there are a lot of VOCs. That means volatile organic compounds, VOCs. The association of diabetes mellitus and breath VOCs has been observed since the 1940s, and it's being reported by many studies.
The problem has been the diagnostic accuracy of breath tests for diabetes mellitus.
So the research found that breath testing for type 2 diabetes has around 92% sensitivity.
The best VOCs for diagnosing diabetes were isotopic carbon dioxide, isopropanol, dimethyl sulfide, and acetone, with the very best being the first, isotopic carbon dioxide.
We cannot yet talk about an actual treatment of diabetes, such that the diabetic is no longer considered diabetic, but cured. But we do have some new treatments, including one called the Omnipod. Many diabetics have opted for the insulin pump. Here, there is often an external battery-operated pump that is attached to a needle through a plastic tube.
At certain intervals, the pump pushes a small amount of insulin through the tube and through the needle into the diabetic's body.
So, does the Omnipod have a pump? The answer is yes. Does it have a needle? Again, the answer is yes. So, what makes the Omnipod insulin management system different? Well, the Omnipod is a tubeless insulin pump made by a company called Insulet. The company was really founded listen to this, 21 years ago in Massachusetts, and it now is used by 140,000 adults and youths around the world today. There are two parts to this Omnipod system.
The pod and the personal diabetes manager, or PDM, which communicate wirelessly to deliver continuous insulin based on your personal settings.
In a normal insulin pump system, the pump is not disposable and only the sights are replaceable. In other words, you throw them out every 3 days. The difference here is that the Omnipod and sight are all in one. The entire pump mechanism, as well as the insulin reservoir, is housed inside the pod. Now, this too is replaced in its entirety every 3 days.
The insulin reservoir in an Omnipod is inside the pod and can be filled with a maximum of 200 units of insulin. So, you inject the insulin directly into the pump.
We wouldn't bother telling you about the mechanics of the Omnipod, except for the fact that it's just so interesting to us. It uses something called SMA, or shape memory alloy wire technology, to pull a tiny lever back and forth, delivering 0.05 units of insulin doses.
There are tiny pieces of wire inside the pump which are heated alternately. Each time one is heated, it contracts. When it cools, it expands. And it is this movement that allows tiny gears inside the pump to rotate and inject insulin.
So once the Omnipod is primed, it is then attached to the body with an adhesive. Then the start button is pushed on the PDM. At that point, a stainless steel needle is deployed. It is in and out in 1/200th of a second. Faster than a snap of the fingers.
Once it retracts, a tiny soft cannula stays in place under the skin to allow for insulin delivery.
Channel 4 News here in Jacksonville just did a story on the use of at-home COVID testing. Now, I've heard from some patients who have had the test done at several of the centers around the state, and many said that the test, which utilizes a long Q-tip-like instrument, is pushed up the nasal cavity, way, let's say, at least to a point of being quite uncomfortable. And some have actually called it painful. In fact, several have actually vowed never to do it again. So there simply has got to be a better way, a more accurate test that is not painful, that can be used to test for COVID-19. A new study looked at how saliva samples compare to the commonly used nasopharyngeal swabs for the detection of SARS-CoV-2. The authors of the study noted that nasal swabs not only can be painful, as we've suggested, but are often done incorrectly, even by those workers in the centers administering them to the public. These tests also pose a variety of challenges, including the exposure risk to healthcare workers and supply chain issues, as well as problems with the samples being self-collected. One of the biggest worries is that samples are often not properly collected and can lead to a result being negative when indeed the person should have tested positive. In other words, false negatives. So wouldn't it be great if saliva could become a testing option? Of course, it too has its share of potential challenges. One reason could be the presence of mucus or blood, which could make it difficult to process in a lab, making the diagnosis harder to determine. Something new has been found, which could render the saliva samples more sensitive than even the nasopharyngeal routes of collection. The researchers found that when a simple processing step using what's called a bead mill homogenizer was introduced, the saliva samples showed higher sensitivity compared with the NPS samples. In their study, using the bead mill homogenizer, the detection rate for the virus was significantly higher in saliva at 98% compared with 78.9% of the nasal swab test. So in conclusion, this study has demonstrated that the saliva samples are more sensitive than the NPS samples if collected and processed appropriately before extraction. You know, it's been more than 18 months since the coronavirus called SARS-CoV-2 caused an outbreak of the respiratory disease named COVID-19 and pneumonia in Wuhan, China. We all know that this spread, sickening more than 203 million people and killing 4.3 million, was worldwide. One of the first symptoms that we all heard about was called anosmia, meaning loss of smell. But of course, there were others that were commonly reported, including fever, cough, and shortness of breath. But healthcare providers also noticed many patients with a decreased sense of taste called agusia. So now doctors recommend that anyone who experiences a sudden loss of smell or taste self-isolate and contact their healthcare provider.
Remember SARS in 2003? That's a virus that spread from Asia throughout the world, sickening more than 8,000 people and killing more than 700 over a six-month period.
That particular virus, the one that caused SARS-CoV, is pretty similar to the one that causes COVID-19. First, they're both coronaviruses. But there's a big difference. The SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19, binds 10 to 20 times more tightly to human cells than SARS-CoV.
Although babies are less likely to contract COVID-19, when they do, they are more vulnerable to the viral illness than older children. From the records of 2,143 Chinese children, 11% of sick infants were seriously or critically ill, compared to 7% of children ages 1 to 5 years, and less than 2% of cases were in children younger than 18 years.
There's also a multisystem inflammatory syndrome called MIS, which affects some children positive for current or recent SARS-CoV-2 infection.
This rare but serious infection is characterized by gastrointestinal symptoms and cardiac inflammation.
Remember that COVID-19 is spread primarily through respiratory droplets. So when an infected person sneezes or coughs, the virus can travel from one person to another or via what we call an intermediate surface.
The virus seems to spread through the air, but this is more likely in crowded indoor areas with poor ventilation than in areas with plenty of outdoor air and fewer people.
Unfortunately, it has been found that the virus can live up to 24 hours on cardboard and 2 to 3 days on plastic and stainless steel. Remember the cruise ship, the Diamond Princess? Live virus was found on the ship 17 days after passengers disembarked. And also, people who don't have symptoms can spread the disease.
The CDC estimates up to 40% of infected individuals do not experience symptoms.
This could actually be bad news for public health, because people who are infected but don't have symptoms can unintentionally spread the virus to others.
Do you know that people with type A blood may be more susceptible to infection?
The study also found that there were fewer sick people with type O blood than would be expected.
We may not have heard about digestive symptoms, but some people with COVID-19 have digestive symptoms, including lack of appetite, diarrhea, vomiting, and abdominal pain.
And there's actually a small percentage who only had digestive symptoms, meaning no cough, fever, or shortness of breath.
In general, natural immunity and protection from reinfection is thought to last 6 to 12 months, but some people were reinfected earlier.
The FDA has approved the first targeted COVID-19 treatment drug called bamlanivimab, a monoclonal antibody which has received emergency use authorization.
It is for people with mild to moderate COVID-19 at high risk for developing severe disease.
Another drug received approval called remdesivir. Remember that? It was also named Veklury. That is an antiviral medicine. However, it has been reserved for hospitalized patients only, and it has been shown to improve symptoms somewhat and shorten recovery time in some cases.
We would like you, our listeners, to know that Dr. Lasky is one of only a few physicians in the Jacksonville area that has been certified to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call their office at 641-4411. They have also set up a special website at www.compassionatekerjacks.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. Unfortunately, we have come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.